All right, my name is Francina Turner, and I'm conducting an oral history interview with Gareth Murray for the Black Experience at UMD Oral History Project. That's a part of the Reparative Histories Initiative. First of all, am I pronouncing your name correctly? Gareth Murray?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. What's your hometown?
Baltimore City, actually. I mean, where I was born, Baltimore City.
What year did you enter UMD and what year did you graduate?
I entered UMD in 1965 and I left in 1973. But that was after I did a bachelor's and then I did a master's and then I left to go do a doctorate at Cornell.
What years did you do your master's?
From 70 to 73.
Okay, so 1965 to 1970, you were an undergrad?
Undergrad.
And then 1970 to 73, you were working on a master's?
Right.
Okay, and then you said you went to Cornell for
a doctor. Okay. Right.
Okay. How would you describe your life prior to Maryland, now to the University of Maryland? With this question, I'm interested in your family composition, your home community, thoughts on higher education, that kind of thing.
Okay. I grew up in Baltimore in a community where the question wasn't, are you going to college? The question was always, where are you going to go? The neighborhood had a lot of teachers, some lawyers, some attorneys. Jada Pinkett's grandfather and grandmother they lived two doors up from me. So I grew up with her father and her uncle. But her grandmother was a teacher and she was very close to one of my family members. And her husband was an attorney. And so you had a lot of, at that time, you know, you couldn't live in too many places. I mean, they had basically areas mapped out for Black folks. So that meant we got to live together, you know, from the guy that worked labor, everybody was in the same neighborhood. One of the judges from Baltimore City, Judge Watts, was also in our neighborhood. So it was a good mixture. And it was nice, I think, in that, like I said, the expectation was that you were going to college, period. So in my instance, my oldest brother, went to University of Maryland Eastern, what's now University of Maryland Eastern Shore, used to be Maryland State. My other brother went to Morgan, and I wanted to go to University of Maryland. And part of that was because every year they had band day. I was in the marching band at my high school, which was Edmondson High School. And I loved it. And I fell in love with the campus. And I had no idea of what the campus was about. And so that was the only school I applied to. And my high school counselor, when I look at it now, she tried to persuade me, this was a white, tried to persuade me to go to Morgan. I said, I want to go to the University of Maryland. She said, well, I think Morgan would be a better fit for you. And back then I'm thinking, well, why? Because I'm Black, you know, or I'm a Negro. And now when I look at it, I said, you know, maybe she understood what was going on at University of Maryland College Park and felt it would be better for me to go to Morgan so that I would actually have more support. But University of Maryland was an interesting place. And I got there because that's the only place I applied to. And my high school music teacher was very supportive of me going there. I don't know if he knew anything about, you know, the politics and the racial issues on the campus, but he knew that they had a nice marching band because that's what he modeled his marching band after. So, you know, I applied and I was accepted. And my roommate was actually a classmate of mine. The two of us applied and were accepted. And of course, when they saw the pictures, they put us together. So, there were three of us, actually. My cousin, a classmate, and I were the three brothers from our high school that went to University of Maryland, College Park.
Before I go further, I have to know, which instrument did you play?
I was a drummer.
Okay.
And in my last year or last 2 years, I was the drum major for the band because my band instructor wanted a drum major and we didn't have one. So he basically appointed me to do that.
How did you, once you're at the University of Maryland, how did you determine what you would major in?
Unfortunately, that was one of those situations where we didn't have a lot of help, or at least I didn't have a lot of help. When I got there, I actually wanted to go into ministry. Of course, that's not a major. So I went back home and I talked to my pastor. He said, well, look, it's about people. So just do something that has to do with people. I said, okay. Then I actually met a guy on the track team, which I was on the track team for, I think, a year or two, walk on, because the coach saw me playing intramural basketball and asked me to come out for the track team. One of the guys on the team was a psychology major. And we talked. And I said, okay, that sounds like something. But there was no formal advising. The only advising that I got was how many general course requirements and, you know, how many credits you need to fulfill this and how many you need to fulfill the major itself. There was no advice beyond that. And my parents couldn't advise me because my parents didn't go to college. So, it was one of those situations where, you know, God had to step in and make sure that the right people were in place to help me along.
Now that you mentioned your parents, what did they do for a living?
My father was a warehouseman. And my mother worked for the federal government, worked for Social Security.
Walk me through your earliest memories of the first time you came to the campus as an incoming freshman.
Well, my roommate and I, a guy named Charles, were walking around campus. We moved in, we were in what they called Catoctin was the dorm, but it was the trailers. So you had two guys on one side, two guys on the other side, a little bathroom in between. And the room was probably no bigger than a 10 by 10. So you had a little desk on each side and the bunk beds. But we went out walking one day and we went up to the student union and they had people in the stops for whatever offense they had committed. And we just strolled and didn't see too many of us. So when we finally ran into some other Black folks, you know, it was a big deal for us because we could go for days without seeing anybody other than ourselves. And we were, I'm going to say it, we didn't feel uncomfortable because we had come from a high school that was predominantly white. So there was no discomfort being around all these white folks. But there was nothing going on that basically invited us to be a part of the campus. They didn't welcome us with open arms. Matter of fact, early on, I'll never forget this. We had these mixers where the girls' dorm and the boys' dorms would get together because they were segregated at that time, you know. So we were going over to the hill for a mixer. And apparently they had informed the young ladies that there were a couple Black guys in this particular dorm that were coming. And they must have instructed them to be nice to us. When we got there, I told my roommate, look, man, they don't want to dance with you. He said, I don't care. Charles loved to dance. So he went over and he asked the young lady to dance. And she literally cried as she danced with him. And I'll never forget that because, you know, we're just two guys like everybody else. But we were the only ones there that were Black. So those are some of my earliest memories of being on campus. And of course, I was in the marching band as a freshman, I was in the percussion section. There were only there were about six of us in the marching band. One guy played sax, a young lady named Zavolia that played flute, another lady, Donna, played flute, and I played percussion, and another buddy, Vince, played percussion. So there were five or six of us. And that made us a little different as well because, you know, we were in the marching band. There were certain things that went on. Like when I first got there, I had to teach a guy my name because, unfortunately, he, for whatever reason, and I know what the reason is, he wanted to call me boy. And it got to the point where I told him, you know what? You know your name, you know my name. But for some reason, you can't say my name. So when we get back to the dorm tonight, I'm going to teach you my name. Now, I didn't have any plans on doing anything to him, but I could intimidate him. I knew that. And I did. And from that day on, he called me by my name. And the interesting thing is that some of these white folks have never been around Black folks at all. And so there was one guy, they thought he was from the Caribbean. Why? I don't know. He was from Western Maryland, but he didn't look like the rest of us. So they thought he had to be different. He had to be from someplace else. And you know, we understood how that played out as well, but, you know, getting people to respect you was, for me, it was a big deal. There was one guy that lived in my dorm. We were okay. You know, we would talk sometimes. We were in the same class. But in the mornings when I was walking to class, if he walked by me, instead of calling me by my name, he said, "What's up, boy?" And so I started calling him and saying, "What?" When I started doing that, he stopped speaking to me. You know, so I had never had to deal with blatant racism until I got to University of Maryland. Not to say it didn't, well, I knew it existed in my high school, but it wasn't with the teachers because the principal was notorious. He was a retired lieutenant colonel from the Air Force, Colonel Rankin. He basically, and it's hard to believe how he behaved back then, but in the 60s, he did not play when it came to treating the students equally. And we were at a predominantly white high school. And I mean, he ran it like you were in the military and you followed the orders. And his order was we were all going to be treated the same. And he basically managed to get teachers to buy into that. So much so that some of us are still in touch with some of the teachers from back then, those who are still living. It was a good experience with him. But when I got to Maryland, it was totally, totally new, totally different. And so that was the early days. And I marched for 2 years. And I quit after my second year because I shared with you, I was a drum major in high school. The drum major that we had after my freshman year, the drum major we had left, graduated. So the call went out for auditions for drum major. So good. Criteria, you had to have at least 1 year marching experience, which I had. You had to have prior experience as a drum major, which I had. You need to be tall, which I have. I'm 6'6". So I figure this is a lock. Of all the guys that interviewed, that auditioned, I was the only one that had prior marching experience with the band. The only one that was a drum major in high school. And I was the tallest one there. There was another guy that was almost as tall, but he didn't have the experience. Well, who did they select? A guy that played upright bass, which meant he never marched. He was not a drum major in high school. You know, and he was about 5'4". We called him Stubby. And so I asked Dr. Wakefield, John Wakefield was his name. I said, "What happened? I mean, why was it not?" The excuse that they gave was that I was too tall.
Your sound went out a little bit.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now. You said his excuse was...
His excuse was I was too tall. And because I was so tall, they would have to alter the uniform, some excuse. And I told him, this is my last year marching.
It went out again.
Okay. Let me see if I can. I can't hear you. Okay.
Well, your sound kind of goes out for a moment and comes right back. I'm not sure. But I did get what you said about him saying they may have to alter the uniform.
Yeah. And I told him I quit after I told him that I was going to quit. So this is my last year marching. Because, you know, it's not right. You know, if you're going to treat me that way, I can't march in this band. And so I stopped. So that was some of the craziness. And then you go over and you look at someone like Jim Kehoe, which was the track and field coach. And he is, I mean, he had his issues like everybody else, but he was the kind of a person who I think was more interested in what you brought to the table. For example, at that time at University of Maryland, they pretty much had an unwritten rule. They never brought in more than two Black athletes for your major sports. So you can go back in time and look at who they brought in basketball-wise, Pete Johnson and Bill Jones. When Darryl came, he was the only one. And then Ernie Terrain and Skip Lee came together, package deal. But when track recruited, he recruited as many, if you could help him win, he didn't care. So track and field had a ton of Black guys compared to the other sports. When I say a ton, you know, six or seven. But Coach Kehoe was a straight up guy. And I say that because Earl Wynn and Bobby McLeod started Black Student Union, basically. And we decided to demonstrate during the State of the University address, which Dr. Elkins was giving. So here we are at Cole Fieldhouse. He starts his address. We stand up and we walk down onto the main floor. And folks see us coming onto the floor. And now the state troopers must have gotten wind of what was going to happen because they were already in the wings position. And we are walking onto the floor. And Dr. Elkins said, "Do you want to hear me? Or do you want to hear these niggers?" His words, okay? Folks started screaming, "Shoot the niggers, shoot the niggers, shoot the niggers." And the state troopers came out, with their clubs to, they didn't beat us, but they basically pushed us off the floor. And we went back over to the student union to have a meeting, basically, to process what had gone on. Well, later on that day, I had track practice. So I get down to the field and Coach Kehoe says, "Young man, I need to speak to you." I said, "Okay, Coach." So I go over, he says, "I understand that you were participating in an activity this morning." I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Well, what was it? Because I heard that you were demonstrating, and I take a very dim view of my guys participating in those kinds of activities." I said, "Well, Coach, I pay the same tuition and fees as everybody else does. But for whatever reason, I don't get the same services. And so we decided we needed to say something about it." He looked at me and he said, "Okay, let's have a good day of practice." And that was it. He understood what I was talking about. Matter of fact, he used to write letters of recommendation for me for grad school. And I stayed in touch with him. That was, early on what it was like.
Could you repeat what Dr. Elkins said again? Do you want to hear me?
He said, "Do you want to hear me? Okay. Or do you want to hear these Negros?" He was from Texas. I think he was from Texas. That's basically what he said. Now, is that recorded in the archives anywhere? I doubt it. But that's what the man said. I was there And then, you know, and the crowd started to shoot the niggas.
You mentioned earlier, in the earlier part of your discussion about your residence hall, but I didn't mm-hmm. catch the name of your residence hall.
Catoctin. C-A, Catoctin, like the part of the state, Catoctin Mountains.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
And were you there all 4 years?
No, thank the Lord. I was only there for 1 year. And then they opened Ellicott Hall. It was brand new dorm, and folks from the trailers got first take. So we moved up to Ellicott Hall. And that's where I was. Well, I was in Ellicott for another 2 years. And then when the co-ed dorms opened, I was the first Black student in Hagerstown Hall. I was the only Black student in Hagerstown Hall until I talked a couple of my friends into coming over there. Because it was an experiment, we had to go through an interview. And you had to have a certain grade point average. And, you know, what it came down to was they wanted, I guess they were attempting to make the thing work this co-ed thing. But yeah, I was the only Black student in the dorm. And then I talked to a friend of mine from the track team, a guy named Roland Merritt, who was the rock star on the track team. He was a sprinter, and then he played football. But the two of us were the only Black folks. And then we got a couple young ladies that we knew to move in as well. But it was, again, a unique experience.
You mentioned being a part of a Black student union protest. Was the Black student union, considering your band and your track, did you belong to any other organizations other than the Black Student Union?
That was pretty much it. Black Student Union, we didn't have much. There were no fraternities, no sororities. My roommate, Charles, from my freshman year, attempted to get the Q's and Kappas from Howard to sponsor a line at College Park. They said that they would do it. No, Kappas couldn't come off campus at that time. They couldn't. The Q's said that they could, but we had to find eight brothers with a 2.5 grade point average and $48. Either they had $48 and no grades, or they had grades and no money. So I think we got a grand total of three guys who had $48 and a 2.5, and they wouldn't come. They wouldn't come to College Park for that. So we didn't have a frat, you know, didn't have any sororities. And of course, the ones that were there didn't allow us to join.
Did you belong to any off-campus or community organizations, maybe a church?
Well, I had my church back in Baltimore, and we used to go across to Lakeland to church there, because there were three young ladies, three sisters from that community. Jean, Gila, and Connie Sandage was their last name. And matter of fact, their mother worked in the counseling center, not when we got there, later on she started working at the counseling center as one of the administrative staff. But their home was always open to us. So we would go over to Lakeland and go to the church over there. with her family. And then, of course, we would go back to their house and have a decent meal. So that's basically what happened in terms of getting out to the community. You didn't want to go too far away because you never knew what was going to happen. One of the guys that we were in school with was arrested. I think it was a traffic violation or something. Anyway, they couldn't find him for a couple of days because back then, what they would do is arrest you, take you to one precinct, beat you, transfer you to another precinct, beat you over there. And so you didn't venture too far away from campus. But Lakeland was a safe place for us back then.
You mentioned the Sandage sisters. Did all three of the sisters go to UMD?
All three of them were there. All three of them came in. I don't know if they, either two came and then one, but all three of them were there at the same time. And they all graduated from College Park. But there weren't too many people coming out of the Lakeland community, even though it was right across the street.
We've talked about this, obviously, quite a bit, but I also want to directly ask, sort of what's your analysis of what race relations were like on campus? In the classroom, you know, essentially all faculty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Race relations were such that, number one, nobody wants to talk about it. You know, matter of fact, I remember writing an essay, and I was basically talking about racism and some of the injustices. And the only comment that I got on there, this was in a speech and communications class, the only comment that I got was, "I'm not like that." This is what the white female instructor said. And I said, well, you know, I wasn't talking about, quote, her. I was just talking about the institution, racism, et cetera. It wasn't something that folks liked to talk about. And if we were to raise the issue at all, it was difficult to find someone who would support you because we didn't have Black faculty and staff. We had one, maybe two Black faculty. And there was a sister, I don't know if Maurice talked to you about her, a Dr. Julia Davidson. If you look at University of Maryland's campus right now, you look at the academic achievement program, started off as the IED program, Intensive Educational Development. That's Julia Davidson. If you look at Jerry Lewis, Julia Davidson was one of the individuals who hired Jerry Lewis. If you look at folks, the names of QT Jackson, Maxie Collier, who's no longer living, Shelley Todd, Billy Haskins, myself, Alice Murray, Vivian Boyd, who was the director of the Counseling Center for something like 25, 30 years, I believe. She took over after Dr. Magoon. All of us, in some way, shape, or form, had something to do with, well, Julia Davidson had something to do with all of us. Yumburu, Julia Davidson, because Julia Davidson hired, what was the brother's name? I can see his face, the guy that came up with the concept for Yumburu, Otis Williams was his name. She hired Otis. So this one woman who became my mentor, so much so that at one point my parents told her, I spent so much time at her place, she might as well claim me with her taxes. My children call her Grandma Julia. Her son was an only child. He regards me as his brother, so he's Uncle Kevin to them. But she's the woman who met Maurice. And I don't know if he remembers telling me about her. I was talking about I needed to get a job for the summer. He said, you ought to go over and talk to Mrs. Davidson in the counseling center, because she tends to know where stuff is, and she would probably be a help. He said, she's helped me a lot, you know, just pointing me in the right direction. So I went over, made an appointment, met her. She hired me to help her recruit the first class of students for the IED program that didn't come through the Upward Bound Bridge program. So I spent my summer going around interviewing people and got paid for it and loved every minute of it. Then I started working for her. I was her administrative assistant, and I was still an undergrad. But being with her, watching her, learning from her was one of the best things that ever happened to me. And it translated into my academic side, because some of the people that she dealt with on a regular basis, I got to meet. Some administrators. When I walked across the stage at graduation, the vice president of the university, Winston Griner or something like that. Anyway, he got up and stepped out. He was on the second row. He got up, walked out, and shook my hand, because he knew me from us having worked so closely with his department. I think he was over student affairs. There were professors who, in the psych department that she knew, not that they would give me anything, but I think it made it easier for me to talk to them and to interact with folks across the campus. So she was she never gets her due, but she was a powerhouse. The Black faculty and staff was her baby. I was the first president of Black faculty and staff once we had elected officers. Initially, Julia was just Julia coordinated everything and brought us all together. I don't know if you've talked to Mel Hollis or if he's on your list. Meldon Hollis didn't attend the school as an undergrad. He came to work there, but he was instrumental in helping us to get a grant to go away for a weekend. And that's when we formally came up with Black faculty and staff and had elections. And at that time, I was grasping.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, could you repeat that? I didn't hear it when okay. I began. I didn't hear anything after he got the grant to go away.
Oh, yeah. Meldon Hollis got a grant through Dr. Ford, Yolande Ford, who worked out of, at that time, I think Dr. Bishop was the president of the university. Yolande Ford got the money from the LEAA, Law Enforcement Assistance, something like that, federal government. She got us the money. Mel was the one that pushed that. He was a recruiter for the university. If you go back in time and you look at the numbers of Black students on the campus, you'll hit a point where there's a spike where the numbers just jump. And that was because Mel and I think Cleveland was the other brother's name, when they came in and started recruiting. But Mel was instrumental in helping to get the grant. We went away. We still didn't have a lot of Black faculty staff. And I was in grad school at that time. I was elected president. And I think, as I look back on it, it was the smart thing to do for them, because we didn't want to sacrifice Julia, Mary Berry, Mel, Cleveland, Washington, I think was his last name, Ulysses Glee, who was over financial aid. It didn't make sense to sacrifice any of them by having them out in the front. So I'm a grad student. You know, I'm expendable. I mean, I learned a lot. Matter of fact, at that time, Secretary Richardson was over education for the U.S. government. And we had a meeting with Secretary Richardson to talk about University of Maryland and its failure to desegregate the way that they were supposed to. Again, Mel Hollis, behind the scenes, was one of the people who basically came up with the strategy to approach them. Dr. Berry, Mary Frances Berry, was the other person. At the end of the day, they rejected the University of Maryland's plan for desegregation. And of course, that didn't make a lot of folks happy, but you know, we were able to do that. So again, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times, is that what they say? But there were some other things that happened. If you look at the new building, you know, Cole Fieldhouse got a ton of money, a boatload of money from, who's it, Plank, Under Armour guy. I read an article in the Diamondback talking about all of the things that had happened at Cole Fieldhouse. They mentioned Elvis Presley performing there. They failed to mention that Michael Jackson, Jackson 5, performed at Cole Fieldhouse. It was their first performance in the Maryland, Virginia, Delaware area, but it was mentioned nowhere. I don't even know if they have pictures of it, but Michael Jackson and Jackson 5 came because of the Black Student Union. We sponsored the concert, and at the end of a concert, they had this routine where all of the bodyguards would usher the boys down into a limousine, and they would take off before the fans could get there. But one of the guys didn't get downstairs fast enough, and he needed a ride back to the hotel. So one of the organizers asked me if I could give him a ride. I said, sure. So I gave the brother a ride down to the hotel. He said, well, why don't you guys come back in the morning, and I'll introduce you to the boys. So you know we went back. But those were experiences, positive experiences that we had. I don't know if you remember the show about the Black cop that goes to, was Alabama? Where did he go?
Heat of the Night?
No. Before that. There's a guy that was on campus by the name of Kenny Holiday. Okay. Mm-hmm. The show that he starred in.
Matlock?
No, before Matlock. It was, Matlock was one of the shows. But there was something else before Matlock, I believe, that Kenny was in. And Kenny was probably, he was the only brother in the drama department, even though he came to College Park on a football scholarship. Okay. Kenny wanted some other brothers to come into the drama department and recruited a guy by the name of, his last name was Stewart. He's no longer living, but he in turn told a couple of us, and we all went over to hang out with Kenny. And I remember we were in one play that, I mean, it was a bit out there for me. But it was received quite well by the university community. And from that, we all met with this guy named Mike. Mike was Mike's last name. I can't remember his last name, but he was from Howard. And UDC at that time was called Federal City College. They had an all-Black cast of The Music Man that they were going to do. Mike Malone was the guy's name. He was the director. Kenny was the, he didn't have the lead, but he was second. And his wife, later on they got married, she's no longer living, Jennifer, was, I think, the lead female. Debbie Allen was the one of the dancers. She wasn't the lead dancer. A lot of folks thought she should have been, but she was second. She was at Howard. And so we all got into this cast for, you know, it's an all-Black cast. And the review of the show was very good. We performed at one of the dinner theaters in Montgomery County, as well as, I think, one or two other places. And they wanted to take it on the road, and like anything, the dancers didn't think they were getting enough money, and it got to go back and forth. And finally, the guy who was going to put up the money said, forget this, and he dropped it. But that was another experience, and it wouldn't have happened had Kenny not gotten injured, because that's what stopped him as far as football is concerned. I don't know if you had a chance to meet him yet. He was on campus, but I think he's gone now. He's good guy. But one of the things that I think we don't talk about much is the efforts that were made back then, not by all of us, but by a significant number of us. If we were ever afforded an opportunity, we would reach back and snatch somebody and pull them in so that they could reap the same benefits that we were reaping, whether it be something as simple as participating in a special program, being in the dormitory, being in a play, just helping each other. It was a community. And I think that's why so many of us are still in touch with one another. Now, Trina and I were movie buddies not too long ago, before she retired, moved to Baltimore. And we stay in touch. I preached, one of my roommates preached his funeral, which was not the highlight of my day, but the mere fact that his son reached out to me and said, "Look, would you come do Dad's eulogy?" He calls me his uncle. I don't know what the relationships are like with the much younger group, but if I called Maybe or Jackie or any of the, Jackie Jones is in Texas. He was president of Community College of Baltimore County at one point. Then he moved to Dallas. He was president of community college, either the community college or the system in Dallas. But we talk as if we just had a conversation yesterday, even if years have gone by. And that's a difference that I see between the old timers and the newer generation. And some of them don't really know what went on before. And that may be our fault, you know.
I want to, well, first I want to ask, Julia Davidson, is she, are you still in contact with her now?
No, she passed in 19, back in the late 70s, she passed, I believe it was. But I'm in touch with her son, Kevin. And Jerry Lewis, whom I'm sure you know, Jerry. Jerry can share some information about the IED program. But again, Billy Haskins, or who's in Baltimore, worked for the program with me. I mean, we were there before Jerry was even hired at the university. So, it's like I said, she was a dynamic woman. And one of the first, she taught me how to write a memo. It may not sound like a big deal, but she said, there's a certain way that you have to write a memo. And when you finish laying out your case, you tell them if there's anything they disagree with or that you have an error, please respond accordingly. So if I don't respond to your email, it means that what you've written is correct. If I respond, then it means I have to deal with some of the things that you have in there. Little tricks like that. And it was a pleasure. It was actually an honor to work with her and to have her as my mentor.
You mentioned that the Jackson Five performed on campus.
But yes.
Are there any other campus activities during your time at Maryland that really stick out to you, either concerts, speakers, parties you might have had culturally?
Every weekend, student union. There was a dance at the student union. And if you were fortunate enough to get a date, which most of us did, I mean, back then you could go to the movie was 25 cents. They had movies in the student union. They had a dance that was free for all of the students. It came out of your student activities fee. And that was one of the places where we actually had a chance to see not all of the Black students on campus, but a good number of them. And we even had some of the local white guys come to party at the student union because they all like to dance too. And we didn't have too many off-campus parties because you need a car for that. Most of us didn't have a car, but Friday night, big deal. Just got to go to the student union to party. And Sunday, no matter how late we stayed out on Saturday night, if we went to a party, whatever, Sunday morning, a good number of us were in church. Even if we didn't like, which most of us didn't like service because it didn't have much life, I put it that way. And the Baptist church on the fringe of the campus, University Baptist, made it clear that we were not invited there. We may be God's children, but go be God's child someplace else. No longer like that, but back then it was. And that's why a lot of times, like I said, we would go across the street, across Route 1 to Lakeland, where we knew we would be welcomed. But yeah, but we were definitely in church because that's the way most of us were raised. I don't know if you've heard of passed out of Baltimore, Walter Thomas, Bishop Walter Thomas, New Psalmist Baptist Church is his church in Baltimore, mega church. But he was one of the guys, if we were partying on Friday or Saturday, Sunday morning, we were in church because that's just the way all of us were raised. So it was a healthy place for us in terms of the way that we cared for one another. We didn't have too many role models in as far as professors were concerned. And even the Black history portions in the history class was a white guy who was doing his research on slavery and some other stuff. So that was it. But, we still managed to make it.
You mentioned the protest you all did with the Black Student Union a little bit. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Do you remember if there were any other campus protests while you were an undergrad or a graduate student?
Oh, yes, my Lord. There is a picture. Where is it? If you go to the yearbook, 1968, somewhere in there. And there's actually a good shot of, they have a couple pictures. There was a brother by the name of Woody Farrar, who's now deceased. He was a professor down and became a professor down in Blacksburg, Virginia, somewhere down there. But there was a protest and we were on the steps of the administration building during the protest. Most of the time it was basically dealing with the lack of Black faculty and staff, lack of Black students, lack of activities, for us. The Black explosion, of course, grew out of our not having certain things. We wanted a Black chaplain, which they have now. But yeah, that there was another protest, and that's recorded on the pages. I don't know if they call it that, but the pictures are there, and I think Bobby's in the picture. I don't think Earl is in the picture. A guy named Wayne Stovall is prominent in the pictures, but yeah, and. That was something I think that caught the eye of the administration in terms of the ability of the students. Our idea of a protest was not to go in and tear up. We would just sit there, block your stuff. We'd have our own speakers, which is one thing we didn't have very often. Didn't have any guest speakers coming in to talk about anything. QT Jackson was one of the few folks that would come in to speak to the kids, at the students at the ID program down in Yumburu, which was in the Gulch at one point. No heat in the winter and no air conditioning in the summer. Those were the only two protests that I recall while I was there. There may have been more, but those were the two biggies.
When I looked through archival records preparing to start this oral history project, I did see that Nemburu was in the Gulch. How do you explain what part of campus that is?
The Gulch, we called it the Gulch because that was where I used to have rat lab, as we called it, when I was in undergrad. That's where they kept the, they had, the buildings were, what's over there now? It's behind Dining Hall 1 down the hill. And that's why we called it the Gulch. Now, I can't remember the names of the buildings that are there, but they taught your lab courses where you had animals. That's why we call it rat lab. That was taught in the Gulch. There were a couple programs that had offices down there. IED was one of them. But most of them were actually academic departments. And, you know, it was the Gulch because it was in a hole. It was down in the ditch. But like I said, you got no heat in the winter and no air in the summer. And then they moved up from the Gulch to Dining Hall 1. I think they had space in Dining Hall 1. And then eventually got their own building.
In which physical spaces on campus did you feel the most welcome or conversely the least welcome?
Well, if you talk to anyone who used to go into the Student Union building, I could go into the Student Union building with my roommate or with one of my buddies. He would sit at one end of the table. I would sit down at the other end of the table and we could reserve that whole space. That was where we used to meet up during the day, because a lot of the Black students commuted. Majority of us were not living on campus, but we definitely could get together in the Student Union. Some people played cards, you know, you got folks who, and this goes on at all universities as far as I know, where you got some students who actually bid whist and pinochled their way out of school because they were busy playing cards instead of going to class. But that was a definite spot where you could go. You didn't have to worry because there would be other Black students there and you kind of catch up on what was going on, what was going to be happening on the weekend. As far as places where I did not feel welcome, oddly enough, you know, in many ways, the dorm, unless you had a Black roommate or someone in close proximity that you could hang out with, dorms, you know, even if the white guys in your dorm spoke to you, it didn't go beyond that in terms of you know, going to movies or something together. We could play intramural sports. We could play basketball. Matter of fact, the first all-Black basketball team for intramural sports, we won the championship. First time anyone had defeated the football players, because most of the football players played basketball too. I mean, they were just athletes. And I had a team. I was the captain of the team. There was a brother named Rocky who was 6'7", but he was an engineering major. And folks, you know, you get tired of people saying, "Do you play basketball?" So I came up with a response saying, "No, do you play an instrument?" And that was typically when I was talking to white folks, because, you know, just because we're tall doesn't mean we have to play ball. Rocky was an engineer. There were a lot of guys who I thought were good enough to play for the university. But, you know, we have a rule. And we had Bill Jones and we had Pete Johnson. So we had our two. And then they brought in a guy named Darryl Brown, I think that was his name. And another black guy. So either you get two. But yeah, we won the intramural championship. And there's a picture of us somewhere in the Diamondback or in the Terrapin, with us standing with the trophy. Those are the kinds of activities, again, where you felt welcome because it was all us and we were basically looking out for each other. But student union for me, student union, intramural sports with the other brothers and sisters was about it. Classroom wise, it, again, a place where, as one friend of mine said, you were invited, but you were not welcome. You were pretty much by yourself. But I have a project that at some point I guess I'll do. There was a guy in my political science class, and I actually called him and talked to him about this. Sometimes, you know, white folks would do things that they didn't think anything of it. You know, it was just what I do. We had an exam coming up. He was in the same class. We never sat together. Most folks probably didn't even know that we knew each other because, you know, he had his frat brothers. That's who he hung with. But he happened to be coming down the hall and he said, "Have you started studying for the exam yet?" I said, "Yeah." He said, what do you study? "So I'm studying a book, man. I'm reading this book." And he said, "Well, here, study this, learn this." It was an old exam, several old exams. I had no idea that fraternities collected exams. You know, they had files on just about every professor. And he said, "Study this." And I did. And then on the day of the exam, he said, "Do not leave too fast." I said, "What?" He said, "Take your time. Most of the stuff that you studied will be on there, I guarantee you." And it was. And I called him because I ran across his name somewhere. I called him and I said, "You know, Tom is his name. I said, I need to thank you." He said, "For what?" I said, "I don't know if you understood what you did for me when you shared the exam, not because I asked, but, I mean, you volunteered to me." And that was something that helped me, but it also gave me a different view of white folks. And I never thanked you for it, but I talked about that incident to other folks. So I said, I need to share with you what I've been saying to everybody else about what you did and how much I appreciated it and what it did for me in terms of me feeling better about this community that I was in. So we decided, and once then COVID hit, well, we decided we were going to get together to do lunch, at which time we were going to talk about this project where we would basically collect stories from folks that show a different side of race relations, because that was, like I said, it was a big deal for me. It left a great impression on me. And I'm sure that just like I have that story, other people have stories, but they never share them. So everyone assumes that it was just God awful the entire time, but it wasn't. I know it wasn't, you know? So, but yeah.
Were there professors or, and I think you've mentioned Julia Davidson and some mm-hmm. others, but just that you found to be, outside of the ones we've discussed already, really supportive of students, particularly Black students at UMD, or maybe not so supportive?
Mm-hmm. There was a guy by the name of Bob Freeman. He's a psychology professor. And I had him for child psychology. And he asked me if I wanted to participate in a project that he had going on. And he explained what it was. And I said, sure. And it was one where we actually went over to one of the local elementary schools. And I worked with one of the little Black boys in the school who was having trouble. And in addition to that, one of what happened was we had when I had him in class, I did a project where I actually interviewed this young lady she's in California now, but she was actually she was in middle school. I interviewed her as a part of my class project, and he liked what I did with her. That out of that came the opportunity to do some stuff with this little boy at the elementary school. But I stayed in touch with him because he was also on staff at the counseling center. And, you know, again, it was one of those situations where he was very supportive of me and always available when I call. Dr. Anderson, who was also in the psych department, taught statistics, matter of fact. And I didn't have as close a relationship with her, but the times that I did interact with her, it was very, very positive. And not just on one occasion. As far as professors that were not so supportive, I really didn't have any where it was obvious. And I guess that may be because there were very few that felt like they were approachable enough, you know, for me to actually get to know them or to go after class to talk to them about anything. That wasn't something that I ran into very often. Yeah. So the only ones that I can say that I really got to know were those that were kind to me and did things for me. Now, coming up to 2000, where was that? I think I was with a higher commission when I went to speak at the university for some kind of a program. Two young ladies came up to me and asked me, this is College Park. They asked me if I could help them. I said, to do? They said, we need a mentor. I said, well, what's your major? They told me the majors. I said, well, fine. You got plenty of professors. She said, no, they don't really want to mentor us. And this is in 2006, 2007, somewhere in there. So the same issues that were going on when I was there in terms of not having the mentors they were experiencing. One was in, I think she was a bio major or chem major. And so what I did was I called friends of mine. One was at UDC teaching chemistry. He agreed to help me out. The other one was at Howard teaching in the med school, but he was willing to help me out and to mentor these young ladies. So unfortunately, and I'm sure there's some situations where students have been able to find a mentor, but theirs was disturbing to me because this is 2006, seven, somewhere in there, you know, and they're still dealing with the same mess that I had going on.
Before we talk a little bit about your pivot to graduate school, what are your last memories of being on campus as an undergraduate student?
It may not be the last memory, but it certainly stands out. When we had the Vietnam War protests going on, we were all down along the wall on Route 1, you know, where the dairy is on Route 1 and that wall that runs down. We were all there and the state troopers were marching up the street because the barracks was right across next to Ritchie Coliseum. So the state troopers are marching up the street, you know, and because students had been out protesting the war, nothing crazy, but you know, just having demonstrations. So some guy decides, white guy decides he's gonna throw a brick at them. And he did. And at that point, they yell, charge. And, you know, we took off because, you know, they started shooting tear gas and all of that. What the white folks couldn't understand, the ones that I knew, why aren't you all down here protesting with us? I said, have you ever been hit with a billy club? I said, I know what it feels like. You know, you all, this may be fun for you, but been there, done that. And so you need to go on and do it for yourself. But no, I won't be joining you. So I went out one night. By that time, I got a car. And when I was coming back onto campus, there was a curfew. And this guy from the football team, a guy named Sontag, had been out drinking. And he was standing in the middle of the street with these beer bottles, just smashing the beer bottles. And I remember driving up to him and saying, Ron, what's going on, man? And he said that there was a curfew. I said, well, why aren't you inside? He said, I don't want to be inside. You know, so, and for whatever reason, that's my last memory of being at University of Maryland College Park. One that jumps out at me. But yeah, that was a unique time. When you talk about cooking with microwave ovens, think about University of Maryland. Betty Crocker especially. Daisies, those snacks, daisies, and some other snack like that. They used to test that stuff on us in the Hagerstown complex. We had universities from all over the ACC coming to campus to see how our staff in the cafeteria could cook a meal for 800 students in less than 2 hours. They had this new thing called convection ovens. And of course, we could care less what they called it. They were feeding us things that no other dorms got. We had steak, you know, and because they wanted to show how quickly they could prepare foods using these microwave ovens. But that was a good time. A good time.
Now, at what point did you determine that you were going to go to graduate school and that it would be at the University of Maryland?
When I was in undergrad, I started working with Dr. Davidson. And when it was time for grad school, it just made sense. She was willing to give me a grad assistantship. I had already been accepted into the program, the graduate program, the Counseling and Student Personnel, Counseling and Personnel Services, CAPS is what they called it. I had gotten into that and she was willing to pay for it. So it was a no-brainer for me to stay on and work on my master's. And at that time, Dr. Davidson still had a master's, but she was working on her doctorate. And of course, you know, she basically encouraged me to go on and get a doctorate as well. And there was a guy on campus, one that I it would be worth talking to, I think. Dr. Glenwood Brooks. I don't know if you've heard that name. Glenwood was a grad student. He didn't come as an undergrad. He came as a grad student. And he and a guy by the name of Bill Sedlacek, they were both out of the counseling center. And they had like over 100, they did over 100 studies on race relations. Okay. And so Glenn has all kinds of data. He and Bill had all kinds of data on not just the students in College Park, but you know, broader than University of Maryland, but they definitely had on University of Maryland. Matter of fact, after the protest when we went down onto the floor during the State of the University address, Bill Sedlacek was the only white guy in the room when we went back to process what had happened. And he was there because he was in support of what we were doing. And he and Glenn had done all of these studies and had all kinds of data to support what we were asking for. So if you have the opportunity to talk to Glenn, I think it would really be good in terms of having, you know, the data, because some folks want the data. That was what they did. And then, of course, Julia encouraged me to go to grad school. I applied to Harvard. Program that I wanted at Harvard in counseling psych was canceled. I don't think they even made the decisions on to, you know, who they were going to admit to the program. But I was accepted into the program at Cornell. And so I went up there to do my doctorate.
You said Glenwood's last name was Brooks?
Yeah, Glenwood Brooks. He lives in Baltimore, and he was actually, and I would assume he's retired by now, he was doing a private practice in psychology in on the Eastern Shore at one point. I think he's at an office in Salisbury or something like that, but he lives in Baltimore. He and his wife, Liz. But he definitely had data. And he was the one who encouraged me to go someplace else as well. Because he said, you know, it's okay to do your bachelor's and your master's at the same institution. But if you do your bachelor's and your master's and your doctorate, then it's like you have no experience beyond that particular institution. So it really doesn't serve you in the long run, which, you know, he was right. It made a big difference when I finished up at Cornell.
You know, other than time going past and maybe things changing over time, do you think, or could you discuss maybe the ways you might have experienced campus differently as a master's student than as an undergrad student?
I think as a master's student, I felt more confident in talking to folks around campus. And some of that had to do with my working with Dr. Davidson, stuff that she taught me, meetings that she put me into, having to do program planning, recruiting students. I had just grown because I started as an undergrad with her. So when I hit grad school, I had a different kind of a walk, for lack of a better term. And one of the things that happened, I started to look at the stats in terms of the number of students admitted to the CAPS program, Black students, and the number that completed it. Because one of my relatives, my aunt Dolores, used to talk about they let us in, but they don't let us out. And for whatever reason, when it came time for the comps, for your comps, Black students were not passing comps like the white students. So I asked for a meeting with the director of the program. And I'll never forget, I talked another friend of mine into going to the meeting with me. No, I wanted him to go, but he wouldn't go. But we talked about it. And I collected some data. It wasn't, you know, if you had to take my data before some kind of a review board, you know, it wasn't the greatest in terms of scientific stuff, but I had some numbers and I had talked to people. And so I asked for a meeting. Now, mind you, I had passed my comps. But one of the things that I learned from Dr. Davidson, from Dr. Collier, from my mentors, you don't just take care of self. If there's a problem, it has to be addressed. And so I said to Dr. Magoon and Dr. Marks, and there was another guy in the meeting, I can't recall his name. I said, these are the numbers that I have. I've called all of these people and I've spoken to them. I said, for whatever reason, it's like, we do not pass comps. And I think it has to do with the way that you are grading, the way that you're, you know, the process is different for us. When you talk about writing something, I'm going to write from my viewpoint. I'm going to work, my worldview is how I write. And if it doesn't meet with your approval, then we don't pass. It was a good meeting. And one of the things that Dr. Marks and Dr. said to me, they said, why are you the only one here? I said, I'm the only one here because folks don't want to have any repercussions. And they said to me, if anyone dares to give you a hard way to go from because of this meeting, let us know. Well, I mean, no one did. But I think because of, again, Dr. Davidson, her relationship with Dr. Marks, with Dr. Magoon. They were progressive thinkers anyway. And they got what I was talking about. The third person in the room, and I can't remember his name, asked a lot of questions, and it felt like he really didn't like what I was saying. But they let it be known. If anyone gives you a hard way to go, let us know. So, you know, that was grad school. Again, having to take care of not just myself. And it's not a matter of having to. It was a matter of being groomed, so to speak, to always think, because we were judged as a group. So why is it not okay for me to think in terms of groupthink and to look out for one another? So I hope that answered.
It did. Now, I also wonder, you said that as an undergrad, you became Dr. Davidson's administrative assistant. Is that the capacity you worked with her in throughout graduate school as well?
Yes. I was, the title may have changed, but basically that's what it was. I was her grad assistant after undergrad. And of course, that allowed me to do things like there was a court. And you know, there were so many things that I discovered when I was in undergrad school. If you got a ticket on campus for whatever, parking in the wrong place, there was a traffic court. I didn't know that till I got a ticket. Well, as it turns out, the person who recruited the students to serve on this committee on court was, again, someone that Dr. Davidson knew because they were in the same building with us. And so I asked one day, how does one become a part of the panel that reviews students? And she told me, would you like to do it? I said, yes. You know, but I had, until I got that ticket, I didn't even know they existed. And how one would become a part of it, I didn't know. I did know that we were not in the room as the panel that would review. And I thought it was important for us to be in, to be at the table. That moved over to the academic side. Dr. Davidson put me on a committee that would review students who had been academically dismissed from the university. If they appealed, they came before us. Not all students, but a certain number of Black students. And I'll never forget, there was a guy that didn't like the fact that I worked in the North Administration Building. He thought I was a part of the system. And, you know, you get called names. And uncle this, uncle that. Anyway, he punched up. And he had to appeal to be reinstated. And I was on the committee that had to review his stuff. And I knew the brother, and I thought he was real smart. And so I pushed for him to be reinstated. But see, again, us being in positions where we can take up for us and provide a voice for us was something that didn't occur a lot. But like I said, Dr. Davidson was the one that basically, I mean, if I don't even know if she understood the impact that she had on the university.
Once you completed your master's degree, did you go directly into your PhD, or was there?
Yeah, because, you know, that's another thing that she encouraged me to do. Dr. Davidson encouraged me to do. Glenn Brooks. Dr. Brooks encouraged me to do the same thing because, I mean, Glenn had family. He was in school, in grad school, with three little ones and a wife. And I watched him. It may have been fun, but, you know, I wanted to get it done so that I didn't have any kinds of distractions that would keep me from completing school, you know, and I didn't have the debt. I can't believe the debt that folks have now. I told my son, said, I owe $2,300 for undergrad and grad combined. And I lived on campus all of the time that I was at the university, except when I went to grad school. I said, and all I had was $2,300 worth of debt. You all have that after not even a whole semester. Your books, I'll never forget a $400 textbook for my son for undergrad school. Are you crazy? You know, so, you know, I was blessed. I had a nice financial aid package, and I kept it.
What was your PhD in?
What form of in counseling?
Mm-hmm. In counseling?
Yeah.
Okay. Now you've graduated with your PhD. What happens next?
Again, see, this is how the system works. I'm in Chicago at a convention. What is it called now? It was like American Counseling Association or something like that. I'm in Chicago, strolling down the street. It is freezing. This white boy is walking up the street with a leisure suit on. I don't know if you're old enough to remember leisure suit. Guy by the name of Al Hedman, who had been, back then we had dorm parents. So he and his wife were the parents in this co-ed dorm that I lived in. He's coming up the street. I said, Al, he said, oh, Gareth, how are you? I said, good. I said, man, do you know where we are? It's cold out here. He said, I know. He said, I'm living in California, you know, because he was all tanned up, had on his leisure suit. He said, I'm living in California and I forgot to bring a top coat. He said, what are you doing? I said, well, I just finished up at Cornell here at the conference and looking for a job. He said, oh, really? I said, yeah. He said, we've got one. Oh, okay. He told me where to send my stuff. And I did. And I got hired, you know. And I think a lot of it had to do with, you know, it was that old thing, networking. Again, which Dr. Davidson taught me how to do. So I went to work at University of Southern California, the Counseling Center. And I stayed there. I stayed there from 1976 until 1986. 10 years, I did 10 years there. And it's interesting because when I got there and I was being introduced, you know, they take you around campus, you interview, and then they take you around to see some of the other parts of campus. And there was a brother there that I knew at Cornell. He was actually a grad student and working at Cornell when I was there. And he had taken a job at University of Southern Cal prior to my finish up at Cornell. And so I knew one person. And I was their Ivy League PhD. That's what they were calling me. And it went over well with a lot of folks. Didn't go over well with some of my people because, you know, when you come into a place and there are folks who have been there who've been active in the community, who basically are the go-to persons, but they don't have the credentials that a lot of white folks look for. You kind of leapfrog over them. And it's unfortunate. I mean, one person in particular made it hard for me, but over time, you know, we actually became good friends. But I went to work at University of Southern Cal, and I took the mentality there that I was taught at University of Maryland with Dr. Davidson. They asked me to do a course, they asked me to do a lecture on cross-cultural therapy. I said, okay. And I did it the first year I was there because I was new. The second year, they wanted me to do an hour. I told them no. I said, what do you mean no? I said, no. I said, I do an hour. How many hours do you get talking about white folks and how to treat white folks? And yet you expect me to give you everything you need to treat black folks in an hour? I said, I give you just enough to make you dangerous. I said, you're not being a team player. Right. But this is what I'm willing to do. You give me all of the interns, because we train master's students in social work, PhD students in psychology, not just from University of Southern Cal, but from UCLA, California School Professional Site, wherever they might happen to be at grad school. I said, you give them to me for an hour and a half once a week for the year. And that might make them safe enough to go in the room with someone of color. And they did. Well, one of the students went back to her home campus, California School Professional Site. And when she told them what we were doing, they called over and wanted to know if I would come over to California School Professional Site and teach a course for them there, which I did for a couple of years. But it was, again, because of what I learned in College Park and the ability to actually speak up for my folks, just because I wanted them to receive what they deserve. You know, you come in for help, you want someone who's at least competent to work with you. So that was the big event. I got to serve on one search committee while I was at University of Southern Cal. And I only got to serve on one because they told me they wanted me to chair this committee to find a director of career development. And I assumed they were looking for the person who was qualified. Well, the president of the university sent a resume over and I looked at it. It was a guy who was he was retiring from the Air Force. He was something like a full bird. And he needed a job. I told the committee, I said, I don't think he's qualified. Yeah, but the president said, I don't care. He's not qualified. Well, the president didn't exactly like that. Because I knew if he had gotten in the pool, he would be the one who was hired. There was a brother from University of Dayton who had all of the experience. He'd just never been in this kind of a slot. We hired him, and behind his back, he's just from University of Dayton. He got in there and he turned University of Southern California's Career Development Center into the model center for the West Coast. Folks were calling from all over the place because he actually set up office space for recruiters. And he did a lot of stuff that was outside the box. Even though that was highly successful, they still never let me chair another committee the whole time I was there because I didn't do what the president told me to do. So, but yeah, that was University of Southern Cal. And I left there to go work in the private sector with this group called Brownlee Dolan Stein, which was a national provider of employee assistance services. And it's interesting that they were bought out by someone else, but bottom line is I went to work for them. The guy that I worked for only had a master's degree. So we had to make sure that he understood. He didn't know that I had been hired. They hired him before they met me, they being Dr. Brownlee and Dr. Dolan. So they had to kind of clean it up and let him know that, you know, I was coming there to work under him, which I did. And we had a meeting with Howard Hughes Medical. No. J. Paul Getty Museum. J. Paul Getty Trust. They were trying to get the business. We met with them and we won the contract. And I was assigned to work with them. I didn't think anything of it because I was there when, you know, we interviewed and all that stuff. And I happened to be talking to the guy from HR one day. He said, just out of curiosity, did they share with you why we hired your company? I said, no, I mean, you know, I just figured we were the best in terms of the interview. He said, no. He said, we hired you all because your company was the only company that had anyone with a higher ed background. And that's why you were assigned to us. Because everyone here, he said, we're, you know, these are the folks who do the art gallery, J. Paul Getty. He said, we consider ourselves to be an academic institution. We're not called that, but he said, if you don't have a master's in art history, minimum, you can't find a job here. He said, so you talk to the secretaries around this place? They're all master's degree folks in art history, waiting for somebody to retire or die or whatever so that they can apply for that position. That's why you all got the contract, because of you. I said, well, thank you for sharing that with me. And I tell you that because oftentimes we're used, and well, you know this, I'm preaching to the choir. We're used, our backgrounds are used, our experiences are used, and we're never told. And of course, we are not compensated for it. But yeah, that was when I left the University of Southern Cal. I went to work for these guys, and that's how I made it back to the East Coast. They actually moved me back to the East Coast to open the Mid-Atlantic office for their company. But it was...
This was the Mid-Atlantic office for...
For Brownlee Dolan Stein. Yeah, Maryland. Yeah, I was located in Maryland, but I handled everything in the Mid-Atlantic region.
And is that where you retired from?
No, I actually... they sold the company to somebody else. And then that new company decided to shut down the Mid-Atlantic office. And then I went to work for University of the District of Columbia. And I actually started a drug and alcohol rehab program where it was as close to a one-stop shop as we could get. It was a different kind of a model that we came up with. And when I left there, I went to work for the police department in Montgomery County, and then I went to seminary, started working at church, got elected to office. So I served in the General Assembly for Maryland. And when I left there, I went to work for the Higher Ed Commission. So I was the director of legislative affairs for the Maryland Higher Education Committee. And I retired from that position. So I've been around the block.
Okay. What year did you retire?
2013.
Okay. What's been your relationship to the university since you completed both of your degrees there?
Other than being a lifetime alum, not much. You know, if it had not been for Dr. Davidson, I probably wouldn't even be going back to do anything. But because of her and because of Jerry Lewis, whenever I'm asked to do anything, then I typically will say yes, because of them. But the university, other than asking for my money, there's been nothing that would make me want to come back there, unless they had the opening for the chaplain for the Black students there. I'd do that, but they don't seem to have an interest, as far as I'm concerned. My experience. You know, I know people like Daryl. Daryl's been around forever, you know. I can't work for free, even though I have worked for free too many times. And most of the stuff is wired, as far as I'm concerned. And I don't know whether or not the university would really be willing to look at itself. Like I said, I was interviewed by a guy from the Diamondback. And when I started talking about pictures, he said, "You had to send the picture in?" I said, "Of course." I said, "That was back in the 60s. You didn't know that?" "No, I've never heard of anything like that." And it's like anything else, I don't think the university likes to share its dirty linen. But I think it's a good thing for students to understand so that they can appreciate where they are. But I was going to call the president and ask him, like the previous president, I actually called because when I was in the General Assembly, I was a part of a small group of us that pushed the Lunar New Year legislation through. And a couple of my friends here in Montgomery County, I said, "Look, we've got a new president at University of Maryland. He's an Asian guy. I think it would be nice, since we probably got the largest number of Asians anywhere, can we invite him over here for a reception and get the community to know him?" And I said, "Sure." So we hooked it up. We got a restaurant to sponsor and all that stuff. And we brought him over to meet and greet, and eat, break bread with us. It must have been at least probably about 100, 150 people there that they had invited. After that, every now and then, you know, B because of my position with the Higher Ed Commission, I would see him. I would get to interact with him. But I was going to call the current president to see whether or not I could get on his calendar just to go over, introduce myself. Because unfortunately, I don't think there are enough of us with a historical perspective of the university, other than our undergraduate years. I was blessed to be there as an undergrad, as a grad student, and also as someone who worked for the university. And at one point, I actually, it didn't go anywhere. I was trying to get the General Assembly to order the University of Maryland College Park, well, actually to order the system, looking at College Park in specific, to give us a report on an annual basis